Welcome to NGA Notable Lectures, a podcast offering a deeper understanding of all things artistic. This conversation, held on September 10th, 2017, in conjunction with the exhibition Edvard Munch, Color in Context, aims to connect the highly charged and personal art of Edvard Munch with contemporary notions of spirituality. Molly Berger, Valerie Hellstein, and Elizabeth Prelinger explore how theosophy influenced Munch's art, specifically his use of color. In addition, the discussion examines the ways in which advances in various scientific fields impacted the spread of spiritualism and how artists responded to these cultural shifts.
Good afternoon. My name is Molly Berger. I'm the curatorial assistant for Prints and Drawings here at the National Gallery. And I would like to thank you all for joining us this afternoon as we discuss Edvard Munch, spiritualism, science, and color. This program is presented in conjunction with the exhibition Edvard Munch, Color in Context, now open in the West Building Ground Floor Galleries. I encourage you to visit the exhibition if you haven't done so already. However, you will see some examples from the show in this afternoon's presentation. I would like to thank Jonathan Bober, Senior Curator of Prints and Drawings, for inviting me to collaborate with him on this project. I would also like to thank Sarah Battle and the Academic Programs Department for handling all the logistics for this afternoon's program. Before we dive into our topic, I would like to introduce two scholars who graciously agreed to join me this afternoon, Dr. Elizabeth Prelinger and Dr. Valerie Hellstein. Dr. Prelinger is the Kaiser Family Professor of Art History at Georgetown University in Washington, D.C., where she has taught for 30 years. Over the past three decades, she has written articles, exhibition catalogs, and book reviews, in addition to lecturing in the U.S., Canada, France, Great Britain, and Norway. Dr. Prelinger has curated a number of exhibitions on Munch, most recently in 2010 here at the gallery, where she co-curated Edvard Munch Master Prints. In 1992, working with now curator of American and Modern Prints and Drawings, Judith Brody, she curated an international loan show of German artist Käthe Kollwitz. And in 2012, wrote the catalog for an exhibition of Paul Gauguin's prints at the Kunsthaus in Zurich. She is currently working on a World War I exhibition for special collections at Georgetown University. Dr. Hellstein is an independent scholar working on a book that links abstract expressionism with a new intellectual history that includes Zen, vitalism, the existentialism of Martin Heidegger, and the anarchism of Paul Goodman. Yeah. She has taught courses on modern and contemporary art for several years at various colleges and universities here in D.C., as well as Boston, New York, and now Denver. While in D.C. from 2012 to 2014, she was a postdoctoral fellow at the Phillips Collection and George Washington University, where she taught a graduate seminar on art and spirituality in the first half of the 20th century. She has also written articles and given talks about the connections between spirituality and abstract expressionism. Thank you, Liz and Val, for joining me this afternoon.
Thank you for having us.
So I would like to begin by just giving a brief synopsis of the exhibition, exploring the theme and prints included in the show to give you a sense of the type of art we're talking about. The installation explores the ways in which color affects not only how we, the viewer, interpret the work, but also how philosophy and science inspired the artist's color choices. So without question, Munch's color palette is often bold, unnatural, and deeply intense. The striking reds, deep blues, and penetrating greens suggest and relate accordingly to his own struggles with health, love, and loss. The questions raised by the exhibition are, why did Munch use such dramatic colors, and is there a deeper meaning or reason behind his color palette? During the second half of the 19th century, there was a growing interest in the physical and spiritual world. Advances in physics, electromagnetic radiation theory, and the optical sciences concretized many spiritualist beliefs that there is more to our world than meets the eye, especially the belief that color can convey more than hue and tone. Theosophists, or people subscribing to more mystical philosophies as opposed to traditional religion, believed that color had the power to convey emotion. And as you can see in the image on the left, this is a chart that was published in a book titled Thought Forms. The chart outlines colors and which meanings they signify. Additionally, theosophists believed that colored energies or auras could transcend the physical world. These colorful energy fields called thought forms, which you can see on the right, are the manifestations of your feelings and can pass between people. So, for example, if you were feeling vague, pure affection for someone, that would appear as a sort of fuzzy pink cloud over you and could then pass to the person you're feeling vague, pure affection for. So what we see at the turn of the 19th century are a group of people turning away from traditional notions of religion or a higher power and focusing more on the concept of spirit, soul, and transcendence. Theosophists justified their accounts of these ethereal phenomena by connecting them to current scientific discoveries, such as the X-ray, discovered in 1895. Once it was proven that there was an energy, the X-ray, an invisible force that could discern matter beneath the surface of the skin and project that matter as an image on paper, people began to realize how limited human senses truly are. And as you can see in the electromagnetic spectrum, there's just a small portion of wavelengths that we as humans can actually see with the naked eye. It's visible light, it comes to us in the form of color. There's a whole slew of other wavelengths that we just can't see, and that was really at the crux of the theosophist's argument. So for theosophists, if the energy of an X-ray exists, there are probably other energies, other dimensions, unbeknownst to us. Munch touched on this topic in a journal entry titled, Do Spirits Exist?, writing, quote, "Had we different, stronger eyes, we would, like the X-ray, only see our wicks. We would be able to see our exterior casing of flames, and we would have other forms, other beings with lighter and substantial molecules," end quote. So I would argue what Munch is toying with in that journal entry is the idea of the visible versus the invisible to the naked eye. And artists in general at this time were sort of playing with notions of perception, what we can see, what we can't see, and how that relates to color. So a nice example is Claude Monet's paintings of Rouen Cathedral in different lights. He chose the same facade, but at different times of day, so you can see how light kind of changes the color of the building and how that's perceived to us. And we'll look at some examples later on of artists who thought more symbolically on the meaning of color. But Munch in particular seems to be concerned with color perception, writing again in his journal around 1891, quote, "I will attempt to give an example of this incomprehensible matter of color, a billiard table. When you have gazed for a while at the intense green lining, look up then. Everything has a red hue about it. If you wish to paint such an atmosphere with a billiard table, you would do best to paint them in crimson red. If one wishes to paint an instantaneous impression, the atmosphere, the human aspect, one must do it," end quote. So I think what this section of his journal exemplifies is his interest and attention to the optics of color, how perceptions of color shift, and how important it is to be true to the visual sense of color, rather than perhaps the physical properties of color. Moreover, to translate that visual sense of color into a symbolic meaning that can be communicated to the viewer. So Liz, I thought I could start with you, and you could perhaps describe how Munch's use of color has been discussed.
All right. First of all, congratulations on your show.
Thank you.
Have you been to it yet? Some of you have. Yeah, you'll enjoy it so much, and it's incredibly instructive.
Thank you.
So thank you. Color is an interesting issue with Monk, and I'm going to share things that Val is going to talk with you about in greater detail. Monk was always interested in color, and the issue was that it isn't just Monk himself, but he has to be understood, as Molly was saying, in the larger context of art at the time, when color was becoming, was moving away from being treated as a, as a descriptive element in a picture in favor of it being an expressive element, all right? So that a blue sky, it was a blue sky, but in Monk's hands, it might be a blue that covers the entire image and gives the entire image a kind of a resonance that departs very much from very literal color. And you can see him doing that in the context of painting at the time. We'll, of course, look at the prints, but he comes out of, among other traditions such as naturalism and impressionism, also a phenomenon called in German Stimmungsmalerei, or in Norwegian Stemningsmaleri, which means the painting of mood. So that for him to create a mood, he would have the shades of blue and violet that he knew really instinctively would create a certain feeling, would evoke certain feelings in his viewers. And we see that in his paintings as well as in his prints. What Molly has chosen here is two prints, one of which is an experimental proof, which is the vampire here, where we immediately see that in order to create the notion of this attack on the man, he drapes him with this sort of bloody strands of colored hair. So it's the strands, it's the color that immediately suggests to you that something is not right here. with regard to moonlight, I think you'll see, and you know, Val and Molly will have more to say about this, but that he has given an overall very muted palette in order to create this sense of a moon shedding light down on this scene of this frozen figure in order to give a sense, just very simply, of mysteriousness. Now, I think one of the things, tell me if I'm wrong, that we're going to be talking about is to what degree this treatment of color on Monk's part was sort of affective, well, I want it to, with the picture, to feel this way, or whether it was programmatic, all right? And I think that's one of the things that we'll be studying.
Yeah. You mentioned vampire. I was wondering, I'm always intrigued by the yellow on the face and her arm. To me, it kind of softens the picture in a way. It's, you're sort of not less drawn to her hair kind of coming down and sort of evoking blood. And the original title for this, I mean, I could be, was Love and Pain.
Correct, yeah.
And Love and Pain almost seems more appropriate in this, because I don't think it's as sort of immediate and simple as just a vampiric savage act. I think it's a little bit more complicated than that. So do you feel the color kind of plays into that?
I do, as well? And I think that's a really important point, because Munch was one of the most experimental printmakers of the late 19th and early 20th century. There are people who argue that he's better known for his prints than he is, with the exception of the scream, for his paintings. And that particular impression is very early on in the genesis of that print, so that he has not yet added a lithographic stone on which, from which he will have printed the hair. Oops, is that my? Thanks, Val. Can you still hear me?
Yeah.
Yes, okay. In which he has really made that into serpentine, dripping blood. So this is an early impression where he's still working that out.
Right.
So I think if you follow through the, again, the evolution of that print, you'll see that he made it work.
I didn't bring in this example, but we have another impression of vampire, which is on a sort of greenish paper, and it's just the black lithograph and her hair coming down, and it's quite a difference in feel, I think. Mm. So, but this is the example I brought today. So Val, I was wondering if you could tell us about the significance of color and spiritualism in the 19th century, and if there's a relationship.
Certainly there's a relationship. I mean, I think, you know, at this time, we're looking at this fabulous Gauguin painting, but as we've, both of you have already said, color was used to reflect personal and subjective experience. And, you know, I think for different artists, different colors had probably different symbolisms. But in all of these examples, Gauguin and Munch, there are these strong contrasting colors that make you aware that something's not quite right. And I think those sort of almost polarizing colors bring to mind also just polarizing ideas or tensions or emotions, the complexity of the human mind. I mean, I think Annie Besant, who wrote Thought Forms, talked about the quality of thought determines the color of the aura, the thought form. But for the symbolists like Gauguin, and I mean, I don't know, Munch went through a symbolist period for sure. Mm-hmm. But the idea was to objectivize the subjective, right? To make that interior physical and palpable. So it wasn't a complete retreat inside, but how does the inside come outside? And I think color was definitely a part of that. I think the idea of vibrations and resonance is also important when we start talking about Munch and the symbolists. But I mean, as you were saying, like the X-rays, you know, the X-rays, electromagnetism, mesmerism, now hypnotism, this idea that there were forces that existed in the world, was that coupled with ideas of psychology at the time, right? And how do we take the physical in and then project it outward? And I think ideas of auras, this sort of color field emanating around us, where you can find the thought forms of the theosophists. I mean, that wasn't just, I mean, those were physical things. We just couldn't see them. And this is also tied up into ether science, which I don't really know that much about. But, but the idea that our thoughts, our feelings, our desires emanate out from us and then go into the ether, and those ripples reach other people.
Yeah, that's kind of what's critical, I think, for me, is that they can pass between people in a sort of psychic way, that you can communicate with someone without actually speaking to them.
This all sounds very strange now in the early 21st century.
Yeah.
but I do think it's important to remember the sort of intertwining of psychology, science, occultism, and mysticism, spirituality. It was quite a mix with lots of overlapping.
Right. I mean, science kind of worked for them in that way.
Or they made it work.
Or they made it right. But, you know, I think when you have something like the X-ray come about, it's like, oh my gosh, now there's something that can see through me. That was really remarkable to people in the 1890s. I mean, it's really basic to us now, but I think seeing your hand for the first time and the bone structure would have just been completely phenomenal.
Yeah. Molly, may I just add something very quickly? I think you will, one also has to remember, we know Munk was very interested in psychology, just as Val is saying, and to a degree, spiritualism. We do know that there was a spiritualist, the pastor Stohan. We're going to mention Stohan, who was doing spiritualism in Christiania or Oslo when Munk was a child, and Munk changed the lantern slide and things like that for him. But it was very complex for Munk because his father was extremely religious. So Munk's own relationship with God, as opposed to his interests in spiritualism or maybe theosophy, it gets all very, very complicated and intertwined. And I think there is a point at which, you know, it was more one thing than another. And I'll sort of argue again for being very careful about assigning any kind of programmatic, you know, red equals, though there are aspects of it. But it's not as if you're dealing with Kandinsky, for example. Is that fair to say?
Oh, completely. I mean, I think, you know, I put up the chart earlier of how specific colors connote specific meanings, but, you know, Munk, as far as I know, didn't have that chart. He never read thought forms, as far as I know. So it's certainly sort of a theoretical approach, but in some ways valid. I don't know if you can speak to this, but I read that Gustav Schiffler, who wrote an early catalog of Munk's work, claimed that Munk could see auras around people. I don't know if you've ever come across that.
I mean, I've read that too. Yeah.
No, or if you believe that is true.
I think there are different times at which he did, and I think he was very much seduced by the prevalence of that kind of thinking at the time.
I mean, this would also be a good time to introduce spirit photography. The time, which, you know, spiritualism originates in the United States in the 1840s. By the 1880s, it's migrated to Europe and Norway in particular. And, you know, it's this idea that we, the living, can communicate with the dead. And the spirit is this sort of misty substance that exists in the physical world alongside of us. And, of course, we can't see this. Most people can't see this on a daily basis at a regular time. But there were lots of experiments with photography at the time to try and capture that. So there's a whole genre of spirit photography, and you see people, women in their nice fancy dresses with this misty imminence next to them. Of course, all of this is later debunked as photographic manipulation of negatives. But there was, I mean, this was, people were talking about these experiments and how do you document the spirit life. And Munk was definitely, as you said, taken in by this to some degree or whatever degree, we're not entirely sure. But I think, again, trying to make visible the invisible, right?
Yeah. Right. Well, and there was this concept too of deathbed photography, where when someone passed, you tried to photograph them at that very minute to capture their spirit leaving their body. And you see some of these photographs, and I mean, you know, there's something there. Whether, you know, I don't know what that is, but it's interesting. There was this fascination with the spirit and the soul and kind of this dimension that it can reach beyond the physical world.
And of course, given Munk's own family history, you know, losing his mother when he was 5, losing his favorite sister, Sophie, when she was 15, he was 13. You know, he said, I was born with the angels of death at my cradle. And I think there's no question that he was working out these kinds of things particularly in his famous painting, The Sick Child, where he literally dripped things across and scored it with the end of his brush in order to create the sense of tears. His tears, yeah, right. So making that as real as possible.
So we've kind of already touched on my next question, but Liz, I was wondering if you could speak to just some basic biographical information on Munch, specifically during the 1890s. I believe he was in Berlin at the time. And so who was he spending time with? Kind of were there any intellectual groups he was part of that really sort of discussed these topics?
Well,
and I brought August Strindberg here.
Yes, you've made it very visual. So Munch, he had those three national scholarships in Paris, and then he went to Berlin, and, you know, the German spirit, if one goes with national stereotypes, was much more sympathetic to his very personal, intense, what would later be called expressionistic approach to things. And so it was really from 1892 on, from Berlin, that he found fame, even if it was a succès de scandale. But so in answer to your question, there was a whole group of, he had hung out with bohemians in Christiania, again, later Oslo, but in Berlin, they all gathered, you know, the way they gathered in your book that you discuss, at a cafe called At the Black Piglet, and, you know, they talked about philosophy, all sorts of things. They were jealous about women, they experimented in all sorts of ways, they drank too much, but then there were a couple of genuine crazies like Strindberg, you know, the Swedish playwright. And, I mean, he was brilliant, as we all know, but you talk about science, thought that Munch was utilizing this newly discovered machine that could create poison gas, that Munch was using that to kill Strindberg. So that is one of many people, the environment that he was hanging out in, which is interesting because his own, the people who were buying his work were pretty much solid middle-class Germans, but his environment was hippies, I mean, so to speak. So go on, you were about
to... I was obviously reading up on Munch and came across an interesting character, a Polish writer, Stanisław Szybyszewski.
Good for you for pronouncing that.
Sorry for my terrible pronunciation, probably. Yeah. But I don't know very much about him, but again, good friends with Munch and Strindberg, very interested in the transmission of thought and how that worked. Also a self-proclaimed Satanist. It was very much a occult circle that he was traveling in Berlin, and from what I gather, also in Paris as well.
Yeah, I'm glad.
Again, how much he sort of took in, but that was his. I mean, these were the topics of conversation at the Black Piglet.
Just quickly.
Oh, yeah, go ahead.
Black, you know, that is so crucial. It's, you know, technically the absence of color, but, you know, the obvious death associations. I mean, that printed in pink would have been a different story. And, you know, that kind of powerful lithography, you're going to show a Redon, even though it's a color one, but the sort of occult kind of artist Odilon Redon, the French one, talked about black is the agent of the spirit. Nothing prostitutes it. So that in itself is tremendously full of significance.
Yeah. And bring it back to a perhaps a little scientific aspect. I don't know which came first, but this the self-portrait of Munch was printed in 1895, which was the same year as X-rays were discovered. I don't know if he, you know, I don't know if X-rays came before the portrait or what, but
with the arm,
the skeleton arm. Yeah, I think it's interesting that in the year of X-rays, he kind of chose for that.
There were also spirit photographies with just hands. Oh. As well, pointing.
Creepy. Yeah. And I mean, I should clarify, X-rays are commonly said to have been discovered in 1895, but I think kind of the theory behind it was, I was reading, was sort of understood before that. So, you know, it's perfectly, I think, reasonable to think he was at least aware of, like, that sort of
Well, concept. Even if you go back to the,
you're right.
The journal entry you read about... had we had different, stronger eyes, we could, like the X-ray, only see our wicks, the skeletal system, right? So this idea that this inside of us was the source of...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
Something else to look for here, as well as in the Gauguin portrait that you talked about, is people have written dissertations on the trope of the disembodied head in symbolist art, because, you know, it's that difference between the mind, the imagination, thought, and the physical. Mm-hmm. So it recurs constantly.
Yeah. So this is kind of a sort of open question for the both of you, but I was wondering how you see spiritualism playing out amongst Munch's contemporaries. Liz, you mentioned Radon already, but also Kandinsky is a good example. Sort of how were these artists thinking about spiritualism? Was it sort of at...
I think it certainly was for many of the artists, and I think it's gotten downplayed quite a lot, but... You know, I think, you know, as Liz was saying earlier, Kandinsky had very specific ideas about color and symbolism. I think other artists did as well. But I, again, going back to this sort of whirling mix of spirituality, mysticism, the idea of trying to find something within ourselves, some sort of higher consciousness to... project us out of or make better this world, turn of the 20th century, that seemed so fraught and so chaotic. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of artists at the time were turning to alternative interpretations or alternative ways of trying to make sense of the world. And I think various forms of spirituality figure into those discussions.
Yeah, that's really well put.
Something
No, please, Molly.
I was just going to say, something that I didn't quite realize until I really dug into Munch was how long he lived. He died in 1944, as so did Kandinsky, as you can see. I didn't realize he had lived that long. And so he lived through two world wars, and not to mention all of the tragedy in his personal life. So, yeah, I can certainly imagine how concerned he would be with kind of purpose and sort of the nature of things. And
Well, that's actually very interesting, because it goes back to the evolution of Munch's ideas about color and the evolution of his contemporaries' ideas about colors, and then next generations, whom you're going to show. Mm-hmm. But, you know, after starting with more symbolist kind of color, and as you said, making the invisible visible, which actually was written about quite specifically by one of the symbolist critics of the day, Gustav Kahn, in the 1880s. One of the things Kandinsky tries to do is make it programmatic. Green means this, the way, I guess, the theosophists did. And of course, he was very influenced by that as well. But Munch, in my opinion, manages to avoid that. He's, I'd argue, almost too great to go by a pattern book, you know? And these things occur to him somehow, and he talks. They have meaning, but it isn't pattern book. And even, you know, Kandinsky, he wrote his book called Sounds, you know, where he goes, yellow basically equals this. And I wanted, and then I'll be quiet, but I just wanted to refer to a very famous French poem by Arthur Rimbaud, which was written in 1871, but not published until 1883. And Rimbaud precisely is going after that kind, that phenomenon of synesthesia, where, you know, different senses overlap with each other. For example, you can hear a color that's, you know, all these pictures are soaked in that. And Kandinsky, of course, sees his paintings as symphonies. And Munch mentions that too. But just to read you the first line of Rimbaud's poem called Vowels, he says, A, black, E, white, I, red, O, U, green, O, blue. Okay? That's pretty definite. And it's also pretty individual. Mm-hmm. But just to put it, another thing in terms of the contemporaries and the writers.
There were certainly books on color and music and how those two went together in the sort of end of the 19th century. I don't know if Munch ever read those or color theory manuals like Chevreuil's Principles of and the Harmony of Color.
I think everyone knew them.
Yeah.
Goethe, Chevreul, yeah. Rude.
So I just wanted to finish up our discussion here, and then we'll get to questions that you may have. How can we, or how should we interpret this time that happened at the end of the 19th century now? Have these themes continued into the 20th century and today, and do they still resonate with artists?
I don't know about now. Okay. I can say a little bit about, you know, the mid 20th century. Mm-hmm. Mark Rothko was not a theosophist or an occultist,
right.
But he did, I think, similarly to Munch, had this idea that as an artist, he took in the world and made it and understood it in his own way, and his art was then the remanifestation of that. And one of my favorite quotes from Rothko, he writes this in the early 40s. He wrote, men's senses collect and accumulate, the emotions in mind convert and order, and through the medium of art, they are emitted to participate again in the life stream where in turn they will stimulate action in other men. And one of the things that strikes me, and this is, it seems kind of a strange sentiment at this time, but the idea that going back to the idea of vibrations or correspondence or a life force, I think for Rothko and frankly many of the other abstract expressionists, there was this sense of sort of connectedness, you know, world to painting to viewer, and it was something. That was important, like that. I don't want to call it communication, but the resonance of the painting was kind of a physical phenomenon for them, in the same way that I think Munch and others of the late 19th century were interested in, I mean, more specifically trying to make those vibrations of aura visible. I mean, that's not what Rothko is doing, but the same idea of sort of a connectedness, I think, runs at least through the first half of the 20th century.
Yeah, I mean, I think when you, I brought in Rothko because a lot of people, I think, feel a sort of spiritual connection with his paintings. If you go to the Rothko Chapel or our Rothko room here,
or I was going to say the tower now.
Yeah. you know, I think when you're surrounded by these big, colorful paintings, at least I feel, this sort of physicality and this kind of connection with the work. But I would argue the same is true of some conceptual spaces. You know, I don't know if you go to maybe a play or even a place that you feel specific significance for. I'm thinking of like, I don't know, Spiral Jetty, something that's like so immense and you just kind of feel that connection, and even the shape of the jetty kind of mimics perhaps like a resonance. I think it's kind of continued on in the 20th century.
Yeah, well, I think you can usefully go back to the statement that the French artist Maurice Denis made in 1890 when he said, and this will be a paraphrase, that a painting is no more than really a, I'm sorry, how did he put it? That whether a painting, whether it is a horse, a nude, or whatever, is essentially a flat surface covered with colors arranged in a certain way. Not the best paraphrase, but the idea is, as we know, that that's what it is. It's line and color, and it's a matter of, you know, the degree to which one or the other is used. And it seemed quite obvious when you think about it that as people backed away from a literal representation of the real world, that color and line would then predominate. I mean, that's what abstracting means, you know, to sort of take from. And so that when you get to things that are abstract like that, I think you do see more of the spiritual or the communication, obviously, put into here color in someone else's work, line, and you know, they're all meant to be highly communicative, though they do interact with the viewer in different ways. But I think, you know, they lead so gracefully into the kind of affectiveness that you can pick up in abstract art in general. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. I mean, if not, we have questions now. If
you
want to ask a question.
Yeah. Radical? Okay, you know, that's such a really good question, because you're right. We're accustomed to things that were incredibly radical at the time. You know, in Berlin in 1892, they shut down his exhibition, making him a star. But, you know, the idea of red hair, dissertations have been written on the femme fatale in the late 19th century. She always has red hair. And in Molly's show, you'll see the image called The Sin, which, you know, it's not bright red. There are another impressions where her hair is bright, wet red. But, you know, it's like seeing a moon in a romantic painting. You know? You know it. So you're right. At different, we do grow into things, but it's because great artists like Munch made us see it. They make us see things differently.
Yeah, go ahead.
I was wondering, in the latter half of Munch's life, after he met that doctor and was weaned off drugs and alcohol and tobacco, is there any change that you see there in color of his work? To me, that later work just doesn't seem to have the pizzazz of the earlier work.
Well, you have to read my book. Yeah. We did a show in Atlanta called After the Scream, and it's all the work, as Molly was pointing out, or maybe you too, Val, he lived till 1944. I mean, he had a whole other lifetime, and he got more cheerful. He was still very strange and, you know, a hermit. No, in all truth. But he was very influenced at that point, and this is something that Andrew Robison and I worked on for the most recent show. He was very influenced by the German expressionist artist, the Brücke, and by Matisse. So his color, you know, became very bright, and not always. The self-portraits can be very, you know, blue in that theosophical sense of depression. But absolutely, they evolved immensely and showed a very different state of mind. Yeah?
My friend and I went to the exhibition just now.
Well, that's the difficulty with that card. I wanted the card in the show so that viewers could kind of have something. I thought it'd be fun to kind of go around and match. But that image, it probably has faded from when the book was originally printed in 1901. The edition I used for that card was, I think, 1952. So it's entirely possible the printing inks, and probable that the printing inks have faded. Additionally, like I said, I mean, as far as we know, Munch never had that book or that card. So the matches shouldn't be taken so literally. It's more of kind of a fun exercise to see how theosophists interpreted color, how we interpret color, and maybe what Munch was thinking as well. But, you know, again, everyone sees color differently. So I wrote the labels kind of in that way, matching up the colors. But the interpretations are certainly open-ended. You know, if you see green where I see blue, that's totally fine. And you
I think also even building on that, the contrast of colors or the intensity of colors, you know, whether it's a muted blue versus a bright blue, or the green of the woman's eyes in The Sin. Mm-hmm. Those are, so it's like the greenest green you'll see. Mm-hmm. Or the muted reds, or even just like the contrast of colors in a given print. I mean, I think all of those other qualities of the color, whatever the color is, contribute greatly to the interpretation as well. Mm-hmm.
On the prints?
Yes.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I mean, they're in very good shape, but yeah, they're pretty old, so I think that they have faded a little bit.
I think it depends on the impression. I mean, this collection, the Epstein collection, is outstanding. But you know, there are these colors that are fugitive, but that's another reason why it's so rewarding to look at the multiple impressions, because Munch he's very experimental with shades that don't always differ all that much. So again, with regard to The Sin, and you were talking about the green eyes, yeah, there are versions where the hair is really bright red. So, you know, you wonder. But on the whole, I think the condition of these prints is high. It's good, but it's reasonable. Yeah.
Could you discuss the scream and the various versions of the scream in terms of your conversation today on spiritualism and color and meaning, etc.?
That's a good question.
Okay, The Scream is, of course, the best known of Munch's work. It was a sensation when it came out. The painting came first in 1893, and of course it's become more and more famous because of, at the time, fetching the highest price ever for a work of art. But the fact is that it has never left the imagination. It's one of those iconic pictures that, you know, to talk about cultural, and that was such an interesting question, people seem to get it. You know, what they don't get is the fact that Munch wrote a poem, a prose poem, to go with it, which tells us that that figure, like that, it is not screaming. It is nature around it that's screaming. And the figure is reacting in some way. But he talks about that sunset in Oslo, you know, being the sky was blood red, and, you know, he stopped, his friends moved ahead. You'll see the friends in the picture. And I felt, he doesn't say heard, he says, I felt the great scream through nature. So, you know, I mean, that is pretty cross-cultural, I would think. I mean, we can talk about it as the birth of modernity or something like that, of the new spirit coming to grips with all of modern ideas. But I think it's... I know that Val and I were talking, and Val, you were saying some really important things earlier about line and expressivity of line. So there's definitely the colors, which he describes. And by the way, an Oslo sunset in the winter looks exactly like that. You know, exactly. Was it Krakatoa? Who knows? But why do you talk about that line?
Well, I think the lines... so often in Munch seem to be about those vibratory resonances. Mm. You know, I mean, if you're talking about the scream of nature, the sound waves that, I mean, not so literal, of course, but it seems to me that the way Munch uses line, especially in so many of his prints, is to, you know, they emanate and they come into contact with other lines.
Good.
I think, again, vibrations and ether science are important here, but...
Yeah.
Don't get into that.
No, I think that's really important. Did you ask, by the way, about versions? I can't quite see who you are.
I've seen different versions.
Correct.
Also.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, just quickly, because I know we have to go on. This version that Molly chose is considered the version. It's in the National Gallery of Oslo, and then the one that was sold is pretty quintessential, too. But Munch redid his themes over and over again, okay? So that's why, just in a nutshell, there are others.
I mean, I think that also maybe speaks to the fact why it's hard to say Munch thought yellow meant this or green mm-hmm. meant uh-huh. this, because mm-hmm. he did try them in so many ways, and the different versions mm-hmm. have different resonances mm-hmm. Or the tensions or the contrasts feel different. Mm-hmm.
That's a great point. Yeah.
Yeah, in the middle.
Talking about it was called Love and Pain 4 years, 5 years before the title changed. Was there a version with
Yeah.
I mean, I think I don't know that much about his relationship with women, but it was fraught.
It was very fraught.
I mean, I was reading the biography in the last few weeks, and he was also involved with other thinkers in Norway who advocated free love and polyamory, and there were love triangles and rectangles and rhomboids. And so I think that Munch was drawn into that, and there were some very remarkable women who were also a part of that scene that Munch was drawn to and had very contentious relationships with. Mm-hmm. And so I think something, you know, an image like the vampire, love and pain, speaks to those connections that he was having in the 1880s and 90s.
Yeah. Actually, what's also interesting to build on what Val is saying is that it was Strindberg who gave the picture that title. Mm-hmm. Strindberg, you know, who was a complete mess with regard to women and a lot of things. It's actually really sad. But, you know, he created great art, and that's what Munch did, too, with his suffering. But so Strindberg saw these pictures, and he saw that Munch was painting this figure, which was, you know, a friend of his. He said, bend your head over her, and he did. And later, when Strindberg saw a number of these paintings, he renamed them Vampire, Madonna, a couple of others, so that it shows you something about titles as well, how much they can influence the way an image is perceived. So that's an important question, and it gives you a whole different sense of things when, because Munch himself said, oh, it's just a woman kissing the neck of a man. Well, in his further versions, Strindberg was more correct. And otherwise, I'm so glad Val, you know, talked about the relationship with women, because frankly, we could sit here for a week. Oh, no, longer. Yeah, he never married, though, because he felt that his vital energies would be sapped, and he wouldn't be able to create art if he were married. He had plenty. Yeah, he had plenty of muses. He was also afraid of passing on the insanity in his family. His sister Laura. Yeah.
I heard that you said that it was one of the highest priced paintings, contemporaneous during his lifetime?
No, I'm sorry. I mean a couple years ago.
So did he have much success? I mean, he sold, but did he have much success and recognition? Obviously, him as a little bit maybe on the edge of, during his lifetime, like a fringe.
He had incredible success. It took him a while, because there was so much opposition to his paintings, and the Norwegians, you know, who are a reserved people, found it harder, you know, to accept his participation in the bohemian life and etc. But and then he was doing beautifully in Germany, and then of course World War I, he went home and he tried to keep up with a lot of his clients and friends, but his success just grew and grew even after he withdrew to his estate outside of Oslo. And it's always interesting to know that he was viewed as the great Nordic painter, and no one liked Nordic painters better than the Nazis. So they tried to co-opt him as their great painter. And of course, you know, they invaded Norway. So the story is he had a tank outside his estate. I don't know, but they also co-opted his funeral and stole his paintings. It was horrible. But anyway, there were Norwegians who complained that Munch had so many rooms. Norwegians don't need that many, that much property.
I think also, yeah. Wasn't he doing a lot of portrait painting?
Good for you.
At
yes,
the
thank you.
End of the 19th and early 20th century. I mean, because he was such an artist, all of the middle class and wealthy Germans wanted him to paint their portraits and their children's portraits. So I think he made a fair amount, if we're talking about financial success.
Absolutely. Thank you. Absolutely.
I just read the biography yesterday.
Hey, that's what one learns. And he also had commissions for the Freie Chocolate Factory, to do the aula, the auditorium at the University of Oslo. You can see all these things today. So you're right. Big, big commissions. Commission. Yep. Thanks.
Yeah.
I think certainly Van Gogh, as taken up by the symbolists and his interactions with Gauguin, there was a mix there that makes them, at least for a period, pretty similar in their attempts to experiment with color.
Yeah, and you know, as you say, Van Gogh talks quite explicitly in his correspondence with his brother Theo. When he was painting, for example, his, you know, Vincent's bedroom. Do you know that one? Where he talks about all the violets and how it's meant to be peaceful. And he makes some actually very direct connections with color and feeling. And of course, Van Gogh as well. Well, like Munch, you know, they're all feeling. So, you know, obviously some sort of academic style would never have been able to express remotely what they had in their souls. Yeah, but color, definitely.
Yep, you. Yeah.
That's interesting you say that. I wasn't exactly aware. I mean, Val and I have talked a lot about the issue of, you know, line and things like that. But I think you could argue that, you know, this is the Oslo Fjord, by the way, and this is the Ekebergsgata. It's there. And, you know, this is there. There are the two friends. But you could argue that this kind of area is emanating from his head.
So it does double duty.
Double
right.
duty.
Right, it's the exterior. I mean, as you said, if that's what the Oslo sunsets look like, I mean, there's that representation, but also the idea that you can project that.
I think what I'm trying to say is that this has been seen without a doubt right from the start as being a psychological representation, and that it's more actually of a backtrack in more contemporary interpretation to see that one does, can see these things in real life in Oslo, but that it comes across so much as being his own emanations that it's more radical to think that there could be something real to it than there is to accept that it's all his own psychological emanations. Does that make sense?
Well, I think that's all the time that we have for today, but yeah, thank you so much for coming.
Thank you, Molly.
Thank you, yeah.
Thanks, Molly.
This has been a National Gallery of Art podcast.